Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Whole Scoop Radio with your host, Carol Ferraci, your health and wellness resource, where you get the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Whole Scoop. We're back. We got a great show. So if you're tuning in for the first time, we are a health and wellness radio show where our guests are always highly credentialed. That is the stipulation for being on this show. You will never, ever get information or receive information from our guests that don't know what they're talking about, because they're the ones that have all those letters behind their names that you see in your doctor's offices or your clinics or whatever, because they're the people who know. And that's why it's important for me, your host, Carol Ferraci, to bring you these kinds of people so that you can get it straight from the people who know. I am a registered licensed dietitian practicing for over 30 years, and you'll find me at naturallynutritioninc.com. So, as I've said, it is important for me to provide you with highly qualified guests, but I have to do the business and tell you that while our guests are those highly credentialed people on the topics of which we discuss, it's always recommended to seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. Tonight's show is Men Need to Go with the Flow, Too. You know, we've been wanting to do this show for a while, but, man, this is going to be interesting. Yes, Men Need to Go with the Flow, Too. The call number is 347-855-8894. That's 347-855-8894. You can always also direct the questions and comments to our Facebook, the Whole Scoop Blog Talk Radio Group. And we have a website, thewholescoopradio.com. Put questions and join us on the Blog Talk Radio group on Facebook and let us know what you want to hear, what you think about what you've heard, where you'd like us to go next. Just kind of join in. You can ask us a question. We'll be watching. That's 347-855-8894. You call in on that number, you can listen to the show, and if you decide while you're listening that you want to ask a question, press the number 1 to get in the queue, and that lets me know that you have a question. And if you do have a question, I'll call out the last 4 digits of your telephone number, that way you know it's you that's on the air, so be prepared. Okay, great, thanks. And so now let me just tell you who's with us. If you've been listening to this show and you've been following this theme, on this type of show, you know that Jane Kaufman is probably one of the most first and foremost experts in this area that is just phenomenal. She is a plethora of information. She is a physical therapist who's been practicing for more than 30 years. She's a graduate of Ithaca College Physical Therapy Program and earned her master's at the University of Vermont. She more recently was certified by the Biofeedback Certification Institute of America in pelvic muscle dysfunction biofeedback, becoming one of only 6 healthcare professionals in the Northeast to earn that prestigious certification. She's had a multitude of experiences throughout her career, including Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York, Brattleboro Memorial Hospital in Vermont, and a former Medical Center Hospital of Vermont, where she supervised the Department of Physical Therapy. She's managed a number of people. She's taught. You know what? Let's just bring her on. You want to know more about Jane, go back to our website, thewholescoopradio.com. That's where you're going to find all the information on our speakers. You'll find a little more information as we put it on, because I just tend to, like, talk about them before I get them on, and then I use up all the time. So I don't want to do that anymore. I want to say, hello, Jane.
Hi, and thank you very much. That was a very generous and wonderful introduction. But, you know, everyone, as we all age, our resumes get longer and longer, and that's the problem. Carol has a lot to say about what I've done over my career. So tonight we're going to talk about men. And over the last couple of times that I've been on the show, we have talked about women. We've talked about urge incontinence and stress incontinence. But now it's an opportunity to talk about the men in your life and the men that maybe have incontinence, whether it's a father, a grandfather, whether it's a brother, whether it's a child, anything. But men have problems too. This is not just a female problem. So we're going to take our time tonight and discuss this. Before we begin, I want to make it very clear, I am a physical therapist. I am not a medical doctor. I've been practicing physical therapy for a very, very, very long time. I'm going to share my success and maybe even my failures with pelvic floor dysfunction in men. But the whole thing is, this is just physical therapy, and we work on behavioral changes and we work on changing the muscles. You need to see, or your the man in your life needs to see a physician if they suspect there is a problem related to that particular function. I do not diagnose. And so if something isn't working right, make sure you go to a physician. If you have a problem, you always need to get checked by the physician before you begin any kind of treatment. And Carol said that, but I need to reemphasize that. So on that note, men, wow, have you ever noticed that perhaps your husband or somebody in your family can drink 3 gallons of water, 6 beers, 2 diet sodas, 4 coffees, and still not go to the bathroom, and yet you look at 1 cup of coffee or 1 bottle of water and you're racing to the toilet? How do they manage to keep all that in their bladder? How do they manage to go so long without going to the bathroom? And part of that is because their bladders do have a bit of extra capacity because they don't have a uterus. So what we need to realize is the bladder, the colon, is all inside the body. The external plumbing devices that men have is on the outside. All of ours are on the inside. That's really the biggest difference. But because they don't have a uterus, they have a little more room for a bladder in there. So they may have more bladder capacity. But even more than that, I want you to take an image of a balloon. So let's think of a balloon, just one of the ones that you would blow up for a kid's party or anything. And it hasn't been blown up yet, so it's small. But then you push all that air into the balloon, and the balloon stretches and stretches and stretches. And that little stem at the end of the balloon is, let's just call the balloon the bladder, and that stem at the end of the balloon is the urethra. In men, it's a long urethra. It's several inches long. In women, it's very short. But between the base of the bladder, or the balloon, the round part, and the top of that stem is what we call the prostate. And men's prostate is connected to an internal valve that is a shape of a funnel. And that valve is called the internal urinary sphincter. And that valve, the funnel part of that valve, we all have a funnel someplace in our kitchen, that funnel part of the valve sits in the bladder, and that stem part of the funnel slides down through the urethra, which is surrounded by the prostate. And this is going to come up, the prostate piece is going to come up more a little bit later as we talk about prostate issues themselves. But that funnel, with that funny shape up in the bladder and down the urethra, provides a closure mechanism in men that we don't have as women. So that is, it functions like your kitchen sink or your bathroom tub drain. So you might twist, let's just say the kitchen sink, you might twist this kitchen sink drain to close it, and then you twist it the other way to open it. So when you close it, the sink gets to fill. When you open it, the sink drains and goes down into the pipes. This internal urinary sphincter that's shaped like a funnel kind of functions that way. If you look at it on the computer, it actually looks as a circular valve. So what we see is that when that valve tightens, it keeps all the urine in the bladder, and when it relaxes or opens, it allows the urine to exit the bladder. So they have an extra drain that we don't have. So they get to hold more in their bladder, and that's why they can go longer sometimes, because they have that valve that keeps everything inside. So if you need to, push your husband out of the way and say, I'm getting there first to the toilet. Let him wait, if he can, for a minute or two until you go. So sometimes over the course of time, things change in men. But let's talk for a minute again about the outside of the bladder before we get into all those changes. So you have the bladder, you have the long tube, which is the urethra, out of the bladder. Inside that is the funnel sitting in the upper part of the funnel is in the bladder, the lower part of the funnel is in the urethra, and around the base of the where those two connect, the funnel and the top of the urethra and the bladder, where that connects is a walnut-sized organ called a prostate. So men have that, women don't, per se. So that prostate helps make the fluid in the semen, which carries sperm from the testicles when men ejaculate. Oftentimes by the age of 40, the size of that prostate can increase. And so it can go from that walnut size to its size of an apricot. So maybe like a small plum, let's say. And then by the age of 60, it can go from that small plum size to the size of a lemon. So it grows through age. And it can cut off the urethra. So when it grows, remember it's on the outside, but when it grows, it encroaches on the middle of the urethra. So think of you, now I'm going to switch your thought process because we have to have visuals as we work through this process. So now think about that garden hose in your backyard. What if the garden hose is clogged with dirt? Does the water go through the hose as fast? No. So the urethra, when it gets clogged by the pressure from the prostate, the urine doesn't go out as fast. So men get dribbles. It's harder for them to start their stream. They have to run back to the toilet. They get a lot of urgency, a sudden urge of, oh my gosh, I do have to go. In that case, you always let them beat you to the toilet because you know your strategies already and they don't. So they have a lot of this urgency, having to run to the toilet right away, frequency, having to void often, difficulty starting their stream, and when their stream comes out, it can often be like a psh, psh, psh. It's no longer like the fire hose of a 20-year-old. So it's much harder for them to get all their urine out. And then when they go to bed at night, they lie down, the muscle relaxes, the prostate relieves the pressure on the urethra because it just kind of relaxes away, and all of a sudden their bladder gets to fill, and they have to get up over and over and over again at night. So those are signs that somebody's prostate's getting enlarged. By the time a man is maybe 40 or 50, their doctor may be saying it's time for digital exams, rectal exams. So then the physician inserts a finger into the rectum to feel the prostate. So the prostate on your actual anatomy is just in front of the anus where the poop comes out. There's a space called the perineum. The men have the same space that we have. And in their perineum, that's where the doctors can palpate the prostate. So what they do is a digital exam to see if it's lumpy, which means it's got some excess tissue, which could possibly be cancerous. And also, they do a test called the PSA.
Wait, Jane, say that again, that last part about what might also be cancerous.
So sometimes when they do an exam, they will feel, instead of a soft walnut of the prostate, they may feel bumps and lumps and hard tissue, kind of like when you have a breast exam, they can feel if there's hard lumps of tissue in there that could be problematic. Well, that's what they do with the prostate in a man, is they test, they check
okay.
that by palpation. Okay, so kind of that same little process. But that's only one tiny piece of the picture. So there are multiple things they look at in men. So they check the prostate, what we call manually, and then they do a test called a PSA test, which is the blood prostate antigen test to determine a number, and that number determines whether or not there's possible activity going on in the prostate. Remember, I'm not a physician, so I can't give you details about all the numbers. But if the numbers go higher than normal, sometimes they say, oh, well, maybe the man has what they term prostatitis. And remind me, Carol, we'll talk about that next before we go to prostate cancer. So sometimes
okay.
it can be raised by that. And sometimes it can be a false reading, and sometimes it can be they have to go test it again, and then maybe eventually they go do a biopsy to say, let's find out what really is going on in the prostate. So if a woman had, let's just say, breast cancer, wouldn't they do a biopsy? Yes. Exactly. So it's the same kind of process. You have to biopsy the tissue to know what's happening in the tissue. So some men will start complaining of problems in their 40s and their 50s. And sometimes those problems are not related to an enlarged prostate per se, and they're not related to a lumpy, bumpy, potentially cancerous prostate, but they're related to what's termed, quote, prostatitis. Prostatitis, when you have the word itis at the end of a medical term, it means like an inflammation. So prostatitis comes in two forms. This is where everything gets all interesting and fuzzy. One form could be an inflamed prostate, which responds to certain antibiotics. Another form of, quote, prostatitis is a tense pelvic floor muscle that puts pressure on the prostate and mimics the same symptoms of discomfort sitting, urinary urgency, frequency, difficulty starting the stream, getting up at night. So it's not uncommon for men to experience prostatitis. And 20 years ago, nobody talked about this in men. This wasn't an option. Now people are saying, oh, men can have pelvic pain, just like women can. And pelvic pain in men.
Do men talk about it?
No. That's not a thing that men like to talk about. They don't like to talk about any of this stuff unless they're in like a support group. But it's hard enough for women to talk about it. Men are like, no, that's not a man thing that you talk about. So they might have lower abdominal pain. They have the difficulty peeing. Sometimes they have difficulty pooping. And let's face it, sometimes, not always, is this the cause of an erectile dysfunction. But sometimes, if they've got all this tension, they compress the vessels to the penis and they can't get an erection, or it hurts to get an erection, or they can't undo an erection. So erections are about blood flow. If you cut off the blood flow, nothing gets in, nothing gets out. When you cut off the blood flow, sometimes it can be because you have tension in a muscle. So if you're listening, take your hand and squeeze your fingers together really, really hard. Like make a fist. Make it really, really hard and harder and harder. Okay? If you continued with that, don't stop. If you continued with that all day long, you would shut off and pretty soon you have pins and needles in your fingers. But now let go of your fingers and look and relax your hand and look at the palm of your hand. You might have white spots and red spots because you're shutting off the blood flow from all that tension in your fingers. So if the pelvic floor is really tight and tense, you can shut off the blood flow and affect all the functions. So sometimes that's a problem, and this is why I said tonight you must seek medical attention, because sometimes things look like one thing, but they're really caused by something else. But if you have a tense pelvic floor and you're a man, you might have pain with pooping. You might have the sense you're sitting on an egg. You might have the sense that you can't start your stream. Your stream comes out as a dribble. Your stream stops and starts. You have to go back to the bathroom a little while later, and you're up multiple times at night to pee. You're up at night because if you can't get it out during the day, your pee wants to come out at night. So that same kind of symptom happens to women, but it also can happen to men, and people don't talk about it. So there's this great book out there that's called The Headache in the Pelvis, and the author's name, I believe, is Bradley Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, and he's like on a like sixth or seventh edition of this book, and it's all about that headache in the pelvis. It's just like a pounding, throbbing discomfort, and that's sometimes what we're talking about. And men never used to talk about it, but it's out there and it's a problem. There are multiple reasons men can have that problem. Stress in their life, stress in their job. Bikers who ride long distance on a little tiny seat. That's why there's a company that makes an anatomically correct bike seat for men. I don't mean a motorcycle. I mean a two-wheel bike.
You need a bicycle.
Yeah, a bicycle.
Speed bike.
And so we have like a lot of cyclists up here in Vermont. And we see a fair number of people that have pelvic discomfort because they're sitting on that bike seat for like 50-mile rides. And so pain can develop from that. Sometimes pain can develop from being a heavy equipment operator and sitting in a seat that jiggles you all the time and you're uncomfortable. It's not a great seat. You sit in an office and you work a 12-hour day and you don't like your computer chair and it's not comfortable and you get a lot of tension. And in like women, the stress can in your life, as above, affects as below the pelvic floor. So these men can have discomfort in their pelvic floor, and we have to teach them how to release that tension.
Right.
There's a lot of somebody who does a deadlift in the gym or lies on their back and does a leg press, a really heavy leg press, I mean like 200 pounds. Those are the people that also can get this problem because they're tensing everything. They're tensing their core, they're tensing their pelvic floor, and they're not letting go of their muscles. Men do Pilates. That's another cause. These are the same causes that women face. But the difference is medicine says, oh, well, it's a man, so it can't be pelvic pain. But that's not true. It can be pelvic pain. And the provider that deals with men that understands that will say, yes, that can be pelvic pain, and yes, you can treat it by changing the muscle and going to a pelvic floor therapist who is trained in this sort of management. So those are things to really consider. What do? We change the muscle properties to get the muscle to relax and get the muscle then to tighten when it needs to, but to relax more often than not so voiding becomes easy. Little simple things like sitting to pee. Now, I've been practicing for a really long time, and I hear men say, yeah, my wife makes me sit to pee because it's a lot neater, it's a lot cleaner, I don't mess up the bathroom as much. I hear remarks like that. Men can sit to pee. They don't have to do it in public. But at home, they might choose to do that, and they might find they empty their bladder better.
Maybe, and we'll never know about it.
And, you know, it's one of those conversations that I'm just like, okay, let me put it out there. I don't always put it out on the first visit because it's like they don't know me yet. But after that, they're like, they tell me everything because they know that I understand it. They know that I don't judge them, and they also know that I'm there to help them. And that's really what the whole thing is about.
So let's talk about that for a minute because I think it's an important point to make. You know, we have a tendency as women to think that because men don't say anything that they must be fine. Then after time goes on, we go, oh, yeah, you know, he doesn't talk. He doesn't say anything. And then it's kind of like a light bulb goes on. And it's like, yeah, I should have paid attention. Well, you know, how do you bring up a subject like this? With, you know, you're lucky in that they come to you probably because
right.
they have to.
They don't always come readily. Although I will tell you, men will say, how soon can you see me? I can come right now. Once they know there's a solution, sometimes they will come right in, and sometimes they're like, no, I'm not doing it. So it depends. But, you know, you could say, hey, wait a minute, honey, I listened to this show, and this show was talking about the fact that men shouldn't pee every 20 minutes. You shouldn't get up more than once or twice at night. And I leave the two times at night for the guys that are 80 years old and older.
Hmm.
So if you're 50, if you're 60 and you're getting up twice at night, no, you need to sleep. And twice at night is too much. Once a night would be okay, but not twice at night. So sometimes you have to have a conversation with them and say, I think I learned some stuff, and maybe you should talk to your urologist about your muscle. The challenge with that is I'm talking to people all over the country right now, and not every part of the country has urologists that understand about the muscle. New medical programs are including more information about the pelvic floor muscle and the role it plays because it's a voluntary muscle. Your brain controls it. It controls it for men just like it does for women. But old school urology never really looked at the muscle. All they considered was the internal organs. So there's a lot of barriers to get through. And I personally am trying to work through all those barriers with physicians and with patients and trying to find avenues for them to get treatment because there are a lot of non-invasive treatments that are available. So with the pelvic pain, you want to be able to, and men should void as often as women, maybe 6 or 8 times in a 24-hour period, but during the day, not so much at night. It shouldn't hurt to pee. It shouldn't be a hesitant stream, which means you have to push or work at it, and it should be on a timely or a regular basis. So those are all important things. But to go back to your question, Carol, about how do you approach the subject, I want to share a funny story because maybe this will help women understand a little more about the male attitude towards this. So I speak at the local prostate cancer support groups, and I talk to them about once every year or so. And I remember at one of the meetings we were talking about men that were still wearing pads or when they wore pads for protection after surgery. We're going to get to surgery in a bit. And I said, so, you know, did a lot of you men wear pads after your surgery? And I remember one guy saying, nah, I was fine. I didn't have a pad. I was totally great. And his wife was sitting next to him, and she looked at him and she said, you were not fine. You wore pads for months, and you whined, and you hated it, and you complained. What are you talking about? You weren't fine. You had a difficult time with it. And then some of the other women, because usually the wife or the significant other accompanies the man, but they don't have to, but they do to these meetings. And a couple of the other women piped up. And so we nicknamed it competitive healing, because
wow. These
men will be like, ah, it's fine. It wasn't a big deal. And think of a group of women talking about childbirth. Oh, it was a piece of cake. Didn't have a problem. These men forget that they wore pads and they had a really hard time with it. And so
wow. They're
like, nah, that was easy. Not a problem for me at all.
Do you think they actually forgot or did they just not want to admit it?
No, maybe they just didn't want to admit it in front of other men. That's why we called it competitive.
Right.
So
if you called it competitive, then they talk about it.
Yeah. So, you know, who's to say? But I think that for men, it's a huge issue. And it's interesting because as women, we have periods. So maybe at certain ages we wear pads. At other times we put in tampons. Whatever our choices, maybe we use a doula cup. Whatever it is that we choose to do, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But we have secretions. And men,
mm-hmm.
So we're used to secretions. It's part
right.
of our life. It's part of the life cycle. Men are not used to that. So if they leak one drop of pee, they're freaked out. If a woman leaks one drop of pee, she's like, huh, I really laughed hard. It was a good laugh. Okay, so what? I had a couple of kids. And women are much more tolerant of that than men are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that adds a different dimension to the whole process. But pelvic pain can be an issue for men, and it certainly is something to think about, but always get checked by a physician. So
mm-hmm.
let's go for a minute to the man who's aging. You know, 40 still seems really young, but that's when the prostate size increases. So let's just take as an example a man who's 70, and his
mm-hmm.
prostate's enlarged, and his physician says, yep, you have BPH. Now, if any of us watch television, we know there are drugs for BPH, or they talk about, oh, this drug might increase symptoms of BPH. BPH is benign prostate hyperplasia, which just means the tissue in the prostate has increased in size, but it's not cancerous. So benign means it's not cancerous. Prostate means it's referring to that prostate organ, which helps make the fluid in the semen. And hyperplasia means there's a lot of cells in there, which makes it get bigger. So 8 out of 10 of men, once they get to that age, will have an enlarged prostate around the age of 60 or over. 90% of men over the age of 85 have been diagnosed with BPH. 90% of men over 85. Imagine that. 30%
wow.
of those find their symptoms bothersome. So what are the symptoms of BPH? Well, let's go back to the clogged hose in your garden. It's all of a sudden you have a strong urge to pee, but you can't get your pee out. You may pee and a half hour later go back and pee again, and maybe an hour later go pee again. So the norm is 6 or 8 times in 24 hours. But a man with BPH might do 6 or 8 times in a morning or 6 or 8 times at night when he's supposed to be sleeping. So those are issues to look at. Their stream stops and starts. So maybe it comes out like a psh, 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 or a or it's just agonizingly slow.
Yeah.
And men will say, I'm embarrassed to use a public restroom because I know other people in that bathroom can tell how I'm struggling to get my pee out.
Wow.
Because it is a slow process. When you're 20, it sounds like a fire hose. When you're older, it sounds like the clogged garden hose where it just dribbles out. So they have to work at it.
Wow.
So sometimes drugs help, sometimes, and drugs are things like Flomax, which helps to relax the prostate. There's a heart drug called Cardura that does it. There's a whole bunch of drugs, and there's drugs that have generic names, of which I can never remember half of them. But there are medicines that doctors will give. There are tests. They'll put a scope up into the bladder to be sure that that's the problem. And there are treatments that a urologist can do to help, quote-unquote, shrink the prostate. One of those treatments is to use a laser where they help kind of like shrink wrap it a little bit so that it sucks down in size, if you will. Some people will know of what's called a TURP. That's the nickname for it. It's a trans, that's the T, urethral resection prostatectomy. That's when surgically the urologist goes in and kind of reams out so there's more space for the urine to come out of the bladder because they kind of open up the urethra more by cutting back the tissue of the prostate. In the process of doing that, some men have incontinence afterwards. Some men find they have a great flow. Some men notice that they have a change in their semen, and part of that is because then it goes back into the bladder instead of coming out through the end of the penis. But when they do this procedure, many men will say, oh, I can pee a whole lot better. So the first line of continence in a man, so the very first way a man stays continent is through that inner valve that I mentioned early on in this show called the internal urethral sphincter. That's that funnel-shaped valve. So the literature says that's your first line of control. You got a sphincter working for you? You're okay, buddy. You won't leak because you got that. Second line of control, if you were to read the literature, says you got that enlarged prostate. That prostate is pinching off your urethra. The flow is slow. It's like the clogged hose. That's another way it holds back your pee. That's why these men with BPH get up all the time or have to pee all the time because they can't get it all out. So that's sometimes, quote, called second line of continence. The third line of continence in a man is the pelvic floor. That's the same as the third string quarterback on your favorite NFL football team. He sits on the bench and he never has to do anything because he's got line one and line two doing the work until they both get hurt and then he has to jump in the game. So for men that have their prostate removed, that third-string quarterback has to come to work, and he has a job to do. And the reason for all of that, so are you ready to talk about that, or do you want to ask me questions?
Yeah, no, let's go for it. Let's
let it all out?
Talk about, what's that?
Let it all out and talk about it all. Okay.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay. So the when a man's prostate is removed, typically, and again, if I'm talking to people all over the country, you have doctors that are doing different procedures. Sometimes they will do an abdominal incision from your belly button down towards your pubic bone, and they will go in through your abdominal muscles, and they will operate and take the prostate out. Some surgeons are more comfortable doing that. There are reasons sometimes that that works better on people than the other method, which is to use a robotic system typically which is called the Da Vinci Robotics. The Da Vinci Robotics gives a surgeon an opportunity to pretty much play video games with your, and what I mean by that is the surgeon sits at a huge control panel with a magnified computer screen in front of him, and he operates controls that are connected to long arms that are inserted into the abdomen that have like a device at the end of it that's like a scissor or a cutting device that's inside the body. So when the surgeon manipulates the controls, that device does the work. It's phenomenal. It's unbelievable the results that people get with this because the screen is magnified, so the physician has this clear, very large view of what's going on the inside. And he has all these technicians and other surgeons around the patient while he does this in surgery. And then the little devices are like claw hands. So in my mind, as a mother of three, I think of going to the fair, the county fair, and putting in my dollar to see if I can get this claw to pick up a toy in the machine. And those claws are like these three-pronged claws, and you manipulate them. It's kind of that idea. I mean, it's far more sophisticated and very minute in size, but it just makes me think of the same thing. You have to pick it up and grab it with these claws. Well, that enables them to get to places that surgeons never used to be able to get to within the abdominal cavity. And it's a phenomenal technique that allows the doctor to remove the prostate. So he makes four little tiny incisions across the belly. These incisions aren't even stitched. They're like just held together with tape. And then he pulls the prostate out through the belly button. And then they test it and do what they need to do. And then they attach the bladder, they reattach the bladder to the urethra, and then a man wakes up after his surgery with a tube in his bladder, which goes through the urethra and goes into his bladder, to let the area that was just stitched, bladder to urethra, just to restitch it, it lets it rest and heal. So it has to rest and heal. So that's all that tube is for, is to make you not have to pee. Let the pee happen naturally. As the bladder gets urine in it, it scoots out that tube and fills a bag that's sitting down there at your ankle. So after a week or 2 weeks, depending on the surgeon and where you are in the country and what the belief is, because that changes everywhere you go, they then remove the tube and they say, okay, you can start to do some pelvic floor exercises. So you can learn to do a Kegel, just like I've taught you over the times that we've talked in the last year and a half. So you gently squeeze around the anus and release. And there's a series of exercises that men do just the same as what women do. And we suggest in the beginning that they wear a pad because they might leak. Not everyone leaks, but we don't know who's going to be the leaker and who's not. So right. We tell people, put a pad on in the beginning and then start to wean away from that pad through the course of time. So the goal is to get out of the pad as fast as possible after the surgery. Because a man has prostate surgery is not, in my mind, in my profession, and what I've seen in my office, that is not reason to say, oh, poor me, I'm going to live in this pad for the rest of my life. So I'm going to buy a room-sized case of pads because I'm going to wear these forever and ever. The answer is no, you're not. Not if I can help. That's the goal, is to get you out of them. So what kind of pads do you buy? Where do you go with that? Well, everybody's different. Do you want a thick pad? Do you want a thin pad? Do you want to wear the underwear pads? Do you want to wear a pad that sticks inside your underwear? Do you like one that's more absorbent? Do you need one that's less absorbent? Do you want one that has stripes on it? Do you want one that's denim blue? What is it you want? I can't answer that question for someone, but I can say, if you've had your prostate removed in the beginning after your surgery and the catheter is removed, at that point you might want to wear a pad. And then as you practice slow and steady your exercises, excuse me, you're going to want to reduce the thickness and the size of those pads. So what do you think the first problem is when a man leaks urine when he's, say, mowing the lawn, or he's picking up the newspaper off the floor, or he's going to bend down to pet the dog and he leaks? What's the first thing he's going to stop? His water.
He's
going to
stop
his fluids. He's going to stop drinking his fluids. So.
Oh yeah. He's
I hear.
Gonna, oh stop! Oh, I thought you said stock.
Yeah, no, stop. He's going to stop his fluids. Because
yeah. Oh yeah, he's not going to drink.
Leak,
yeah.
Why am I going to drink? Because of she. This
right.
therapist is telling me I have to drink 6 or 8 cups of fluid a day, but I'm leaking like crazy. Why am I going to drink that fluid? The answer to
right.
that is, if you drink the fluid, it keeps your pee diluted. If your pee is diluted, it's less stinky. If your pee is diluted, it's less irritating to your bladder. So you actually leak less, not leak more. So when I see men and I tell them how much fluid they have to drink, typically this is what I hear. My wife tells me I have to drink more water all the time. My wife is always trying to make me drink more water. And I'm like, well, listen to your wife. She knows. That's a really good thing. So if you're a man who leaks and you stop your fluids, you create the problem you're trying to avoid. You create stinky pee. You create frequent pee in your pants. And it smells. And it's awful. And you get embarrassed. And people don't like to be around you because it smells. So you actually
right.
have to increase your fluid. And beer is going to leak. It's going to make you leak because of the volume. Coffee is going to make you leak. Diet soda is going to make you leak. What's really going to help you is clear water to dilute the urine. So men a lot of times struggle with
that. I think it's going to be too. I mean, it seems just knowing men, you know, just the whole demeanor of a man seems like this is a battle to have.
Totally.
And it's just never ending, you know? Wow.
So
wow.
In the very beginning, Carol, you and I talked about statistics, and you said there isn't much out there. And it's,
right.
honestly, as a healthcare provider, I'm really shocked because there isn't more research that's done. And what I've read that's done says things like, if a man leaks urine after prostate surgery, he should wait a year and then see if doing exercises helps. A year is a really long time. Yes. A year is a really long time to wait. And if you wait that long, you have bad habits in place. You're discouraged. Mm-hmm. You set yourself, your quality of life is reduced because you're miserable because you have this problem. What good is waiting a whole year? Why does the research tell you that? Some of the big companies, some of the big hospitals will say, oh, yeah, if you experience fecal or urinary incontinence, well, really, you're not incontinent if you use only one pad a day. Well, you could put a lot of pee in that pad. To me, you're incontinent.
Right.
So if we right. look at American Cancer Society statistics, now, these are related to prostate cancer. They don't talk about BPH. The only statistics I had on that were the ones I shared a few minutes ago. So we're looking at American Cancer Society statistics from several years ago because incontinence statistics are not repeated all the time. Cancer statistics themselves are all the time. But incontinence
right.
is not a life-threatening illness, so therefore that's not repeated all the time. So what we have here, and this is you'll be shocked by all this. I'm going to read you some of this stuff here. 238,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer. It's probably more like 300,000 now because this was a couple of years ago.
Wow.
About one in six men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in his lifetime. Two-thirds
wow.
of those diagnosed over the age of 65, with the average age of diagnosis being 67. Prostate cancer is rare before the age of 40.
Wow.
Men with prostate cancer are more likely to die of other causes, because prostate cancer typically, I'm not saying everybody, again, I'm not a doctor, but typically tends to be more slow-growing than other cancers.
Well,
so
I'll
all
tell
of
you
these
this.
Things are important. Yep.
Let me just add something when it comes to typically being slow growing. And, you know, it is true that, you know, that there are statistics that say that prostate cancer is generally slow growing. But I know from experience with my own dad, he had it. And his surgeon at the time said, hey, you know what? You're good. You just have a little bit of cancer. Okay. So my dad comes home and goes, yeah, I just have a little bit of cancer, but he said it's fine. I'm like, what do you mean you have a little bit of cancer? And he goes, well, you know, he said it's just a little bit. Well, I flew, you know, we're in different states. I flew to him and I sat in the physician's office for 3.5 hours because the guy wouldn't see me. And I said, hey, what do you mean a little bit of cancer? And he goes, well, his age, and he was, I think, 68, maybe 70 at the time. He died last year at 90, but I'm going to you know, fast forward to that. But at 70, he gets diagnosed with this, and I looked at him and I said, okay, but if it were you, wouldn't you be on one of your buddy's tables by now? And he said, yeah, I probably would. And he looked at my dad and he goes, hey, you know, I have a daughter and I hope that when she becomes older and she takes as good a care of me as yours is taking care of you. And I'm thinking, well, thanks, because you just made me sit in your office for 3.5 hours and wouldn't even have this conversation with me. But okay.
Right.
Well, I'm fast forwarding to I found him another surgeon, somebody that I knew, and my dad opted for surgery. I gave him all the options on what he could do, and he opted for surgery, had the surgery, and the surgeon came out and he said, Carol, I'm really glad you brought your dad to me because the cancer had already started to penetrate the left wall of of the prostate.
Of the prostate,
so that meant that it was about to spread. And I say that, and I bring this into this whole conversation because, you know, men have a tendency to kind of wait and see, and especially if they hear something like my dad did. My dad wasn't going to do a thing with that.
Right.
So he lived another 20 years cancer-free.
Right, right, and had a great quality of life as a result of it.
Right.
Yeah. So those are things that are important. Another important thing to consider, and again, I'm talking to people that are from all parts of the country, and I don't, you know, there's a wide range of what gets offered. So I can't say this is the best approach because it may not be the approach that's available where you live. But all of these surgeries are considered nerve sparing in today's society. So a doctor may say to you, this is nerve sparing. They all should be nerve sparing. What that means is we protect every nerve down there that we can. Sometimes there you can't help but nick a little bit of a nerve. In any surgery, whether it's back, whether it's, you know, something on your arm or whether it, whatever it is. But the whole idea is that we want to spare the nerve so you can have all the functions possible in that area. And so those are things that are really important. But nerve sparing is pretty much traditional in 2018, where it might not have been in the year 2000.
Right.
The laparoscopic, you might hear terms like laparoscopic prostatectomy. Those are laparoscopic, means those are the small incisions like I talked about with the Da Vinci. And the open approach is the old traditional approach. That there are many surgeons that still do it, and there are many people that still need it. So that's just what is, you know, if you need to have the old traditional approach, you do it. Da Vinci, the laparoscopic machine, Da Vinci just means the name of the type of machine that it is.
Hey,
and
we got a couple
around.
Of questions.
Okay, great.
Yeah, they're just it's a blog in, so let me just read them, okay?
Okay,
My boyfriend pees a lot. He is 35. I told him that when it happens to me, it's because I have a UTI. He says men my age don't get these. Is this true?
Some men don't get UTIs as common as women. Doesn't mean they don't get them. Yes, they do get them. but they don't get them as often because they have a longer urethra, because the tube out to exit out the body is much longer. Ours is like, I don't know, 2 inches. Theirs is much bigger than that. So it's not as common, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. He might pee more often, A, because he takes in more fluid, or B, he doesn't relax his pelvic floor as much. So here's the challenge for men. How do most of them pee? Standing. If they tense all their muscles. So if you're listening and you think, oh, that might be my boyfriend or my husband, stand up out of your chair and squeeze your butt and squeeze your inner thighs. Now try to find your pelvic floor muscle and release that. While you still squeeze your buttocks and your thighs, you can't release your pelvic floor because those larger muscles, the gluteals and the adductors, overflow. They send their tension into this little tiny pelvic floor. So some men, when they stand to pee, stand with really tense muscles, and they can't release their pelvic floor completely, so they don't empty completely. And that's why they have to go back again and again and again. So you have to look at how much fluid goes in, and you have to look at how much fluid comes out. So if he pees and stops, his muscle is shutting off and he can't get it all out.
And, you know, how many men are going to share that?
Not many. Well, I get it from them because I make them tell me, but it's okay because...
You know exactly what questions to ask. Most of us,
wouldn't know.
and we would rely on,
how much do you drink and how often do you pee? Do you feel like you empty your bladder? Well, what does that feel like? Well, emptying your bladder means like above that bone in the front, that pubic bone, you know, if you feel like, oh, I still feel like I have a little more in there, you're not emptying. Some people will say, yeah, I can go back 15 minutes later. Some people, once you tell them about it, they're like, oh, I could go back. They're not emptying. So, and it might not be every single time, but it might be enough times that they end up peeing more often.
Right. Wow.
So it's very, it's everybody's different. So these are all the pieces. Yeah.
So,
what about, do you have another? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do, but I want to follow up on this one.
Since
we don't have a whole lot of statistics for men, and yes, they do get UTIs, and I get that they're not as often, it's not as prevalent. I get that. However, given all of the things you've just described in terms of all the things that go into how do they ever get diagnosed unless they're older and they see their doctor regularly? But this is a 35-year-old guy. How often does he go to the doctor?
Right. Never.
You know?
Right. And
so
when so
how does
if
that
he
work?
Says
how do you get to pay attention?
So you say, okay, write down, add up how many times you pee in the course of a 24-hour period. You don't have to keep a paper or anything, but just tell me, how often did you pee from the time you got up this morning to the time you got up yesterday morning? How many times? And usually people can get a general sense of that. Okay, what did you drink? Oh, I had 6 Starbucks coffees. Who knows? Okay, so whatever they drank is going to play a role. Caffeine plays a role. If they drank just water, maybe a beer, maybe a coffee periodically, and they peed 15 times, you'd say, you know, honey, maybe I ought to go talk to the urologist. Urologists see a lot of young men, and it depends on the provider. We get a lot of young men in our office who say, my doctor said I had to come here if I wanted to get better. And we work on biofeedback, changing the muscle, getting them to recognize what their behaviors are. But they have to go see the doctor. So there are plenty of men who will go see a urologist. They could also, depending on their health care plan, talk to their primary care. That's a little bit harder because some primary cares don't have the time to talk, or when you call in and the answering service says, well, what do you want to see your doctor for? Then it's like, I don't want to tell them that I have this problem. But you do have to say, I have a bladder problem, and then they can set up the time needed to see the physician. So those are all, I mean, this is so complex. There are so many multiple facets that go into this whole thing, It's a very hard question to answer, but if anybody questions what should they do, go see the doctor. The doctor could look at you and say, you don't need to be here. This is nothing. They would never do that.
Right.
But if they did, wouldn't you feel better that you checked it out?
Right.
So
there's that.
Going to
okay,
check
here's
it
the
out.
Other question. We're running
yeah.
low on time, as usual. Let's see. Where is it? Okay, I just lost it for a minute. Okay. My husband is 68 years old. He's beginning to have trouble in the bathroom, both ends, which we didn't even get to.
Right.
What can he do? He had a stroke last year, but is just now starting with this problem. Can it be related?
Sometimes it is related to the stroke. And the question is, did he have a catheter in place for a long time? What's the trouble in the bathroom? Does he have trouble getting to the toilet? Does he have, and is it because of mobility? Does he have trouble making it to the toilet because he has a strong urge? If he's leaking poop as well as pee, it may well be that he's waiting too long to go. So remind him, sit on the toilet, anticipate that you're going to poop, and sit on the toilet a half an hour after every meal. So don't wait till the urge is strong, because you might not be able to get there if you're walking with a walker or a cane. If walking, mm-hmm. getting to the toilet is difficult, you might be waiting too long. So to poop, go anticipate you're going to poop after a meal and prepare for it and go sit first and wait for the poop to come and sit, you know, for 5 minutes or so. As for pee, maybe pee every 2 hours on a schedule. Some people, you know what some people use to remind them to do that is Alexa or one of those artificial intelligence devices that says,
I use Alexa all the time to remind her things.
Yeah, but tell her, don't wake me at night. She'll keep telling
you
2 hours every, you know, over 24 hours. So you have to be careful of that. But I have a lot of people that use that as a reminder, and it works really well for them because they don't remember. So if this gentleman maybe isn't thinking to go, he waits till the urge is strong, and then he goes, he can't get there in time. So he leaks on the way. So I would make sure that he anticipates when he has to go and get there before it's a problem. And
wow.
to talk to his physician about it, because it can be a problem related to the stroke, that other muscles aren't working right, sensations aren't quite the same, mobility is different. There's a lot of factors in that. But it's worth bringing up.
Well, okay, so we got just a couple of minutes left. So what I want to do is, I'm having, you know, if people are listening, obviously they're listening, they're blogging in questions. So probably they're thinking, how do I find somebody like you? You know, you're in Vermont. You
right.
know, how do they find
Vermont.
Somebody like, what do they look for and what do they do? And how many physicians know about people like you?
And, you know, the first thing is that you always need a physician to refer you. There are, I can't tell you how many physicians do that. Not everybody does. And in different parts of the country, physicians are like, oh, you don't need that. You should have another surgery. So you have to kind of push the issue. No, I want someone to look at my muscle. You can also go to BCIA.org. BCIA.org is Biofeedback Certification International Alliance. It's a very new name for this organization. It will show you who's certified in your state. I think you can type in your zip code or your state and get an idea of who has a certification. These people know the best about treating your muscle. You can find a physical therapist in your area. You can go to the APTA.org, and you can look for a physical therapist, but many of them don't do this very often, but they list it on their website as saying, we treat it, but they don't always know how to treat it. So I would prefer, if you're listening and you want to find someone, go to BCIA.org. And it's
well,
the Biofeedback Certification International Alliance. That's the best way to find someone.
Okay, and so can somebody contact you or not?
Absolutely. You can go to me through my website, which is phoenixpt.com. phoenixpt.com. Phoenix means rising from the ashes. If you've listened to this show, you'll now understand why. That's the name of my practice.
Cool.
I'm happy to, you know, give me your information. Give me a phone number. I love to talk more than I like to talk to type. So give me your information. I'll call you back. Or if you want me to send you an email, I can do that as well.
Wow, that's great. Jane,
okay.
We are out of time.
All right.
We are
good.
Completely out of time. That went by like a blink of an eye.
It did. I think so, too. It did.
Amazing stuff. I mean, I just really hope for the sake of so many men out there that the word gets out, and that's what we're hoping for. So remember, you guys can also archive these programs. So if you missed some of it or needed to tune in late or you want to share it with somebody, you can go to blogtalkradio.com/thewholescoop and access the archive. And then that way, you know, you can share this and I'll be posting it and Jane will, I'll share it with you and we'll try to get this word out. It's such potent information. Thank you so very much. You are amazing. I know that you're coming back because I'm going to make that happen. And I'm going to be very...
Hey, we can talk about kids. You know what? We can
kids?
Do whatever.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
All right.
We are going to be back in 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, Amy Hart will be back with us. She is the CEO of the Deaf Society in Pittsburgh. And we're going to be talking about hearing loss again because we had a whole lot of... questions about that show when she did it, I don't know, maybe last year or early in the year. So she's coming back, so tune in for that. It was an amazing show. I'm still freaked out by it. She kind of like said, hey, you know, your hearing never comes back. So every time I hear a loud noise, I just get freaked now. So there you go. But anyway, I don't want you to be freaked. I want you to be informed, and that's what we're about at The Whole Scoop. So join us in a couple weeks, and we'll see you again. Jane, thank you so very much. You're
thank
just
you
absolutely
very much
wonderful.
For having me. I'm really honored to be on the show, so thank you very much.
We're just thrilled to have you. Thank you. All right, everybody.
Thank
good
you.
Night. We'll see
right.
you again.
Good night.
And,
all right.
Care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.